Short? Yeah. Sweet? Not really. Solve anything? Yeah, not so much there either. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday today, 22 January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. 60 hours, give or take, is how long the shutdown lasted. There is a deal in place that'll get things back to normal by tomorrow morning. The catch, of course, is the definition of normal. Because while we might be getting used to government by deadline and budgeting by three-week continuing resolution, that is how long today's is going to last, by the way, normal is not what this is. And yet the economy seems to be giving the not normal in Washington a pass. Patricia Cohen covers the national economy for the New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi.
Could you help me make the connection, I guess, between an accelerating economy, right, which we have, and a completely dysfunctional federal government? How do those two things work together?
Well, you know, the thing is that what we're seeing now is the economy has been surprisingly resilient. We're going to have growth numbers on Friday, but people are expecting it will be roughly in the 2.9%, 3% for the fourth quarter range. Job hiring has stayed strong. And so it's like a lot of things. The politics are one factor in the economy, but if you think of it, it's a jillion different decisions being made every day. And sometimes, in general, presidents, they get too much credit and too much blame for what happens in the economy.
Right. Well, along those lines, you know, there are poll numbers out showing that obviously the president is struggling in the polls, but economic satisfaction in this country is amazingly high. Yet another disconnect, right?
Well, I don't know if it is that disconnected in the sense of, look, since this is now we are pretty much in the longest recovery that we've seen. It hasn't been gangbusters. It hasn't been as exuberant as a lot of people would like, but it's been steady and continuing since 2010. And so it's the ship has kind of not changed all that much. Definitely there's been an uptick in consumer confidence and business confidence, and certainly the passage of the tax cuts is causing a lot of happiness in corporate circles. But, you know, the economy has been remarkably resilient for longer than a lot of people predicted.
Without getting into the weeds on the stock market, because obviously it's a many-headed beast, traders seem to have looked at the kerfuffle the last 72 hours in Washington and the prospect of more and said, yeah, whatevs, we're good.
Well, you know, the way I was thinking about it is, does certainly uncertainty, gridlock, all impact the market, all impact business? Business doesn't like uncertainty. Right. But then you have to ask yourself, has this shutdown given us any further insight or any indication of even greater dysfunction in Washington than we already knew existed? So, I mean, my feeling is pretty much the market has already accounted for what has basically been a very, you know, bitter and dysfunctional Congress and relationship, both between Democrats and sometimes between the president and members of his own party in Congress. And it was relatively short, the shutdown. And so I think the markets really just shrugged it off.
Let me ask you a hypothetical then. We do this all over again in, what, 3 weeks, right? Like February
That's
the 8th?
That's the big... There right. So exactly. That's the big question. If it's just a matter of kind of kicking the can down the road and we're going to be exactly in the situation again next month, we're going to go through this all again. The question is whether over this next 3 weeks, will that give the breathing room so that Congress can come up with some kind of agreement to keep the government running?
Watching and waiting is where we are. Patty Cohen covers the national economy at The New York Times. Patty, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, here's another disconnect. The biggest economy on the planet is a not always reliable partner in the global context of late, as you know. And yet the International Monetary Fund came out today with some bright news about both this economy and the world variety. Growth, the IMF says, was higher than expected in 2017, and 2018 is shaping up to be better than expected even a couple of months ago. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what's up there.
The world economy grew 3.7% last year, and it'll grow 3.9% this year, according to the IMF. Not only is that better than expected, but for the first time in a long time, it's not just in one or two countries. It's kind of all over the world.
The United States, the euro area, and Japan, as well as in emerging market economies, that's a very broad-based pickup, one that we haven't seen since 2010.
Oya Jellison is an economist with the IMF. She says the expected growth this year is being led by the U.S. and emerging market economies.
Part of it has to do with stronger commodity prices.
Oil prices are rising, for example. Places like Argentina, Russia, and Brazil are emerging from recessions.
And we also expect to see demand being a bit stronger in the United States this year because of the tax cuts.
And central banks the world over have been trying to stimulate their economies for years, and that seems to be working. After a decade of turmoil, consistent growth is a welcome change, says Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics.
Everything seems to be working in the same direction. First time in a long time, I could say that. So it feels pretty good.
But the world's economies should not be patting themselves on the back too hard, according to Peter Henry, professor at NYU Stern School.
This increase in growth relative to the last year is still below the pre-financial crisis levels of growth.
He says the tax cuts in the U.S. are a sugar high. And even the IMF predicts the deficits they cause will be a drag on the economy later. Both Henry and the IMF suggest the world's economies use the good times to prepare for the bad, focus on infrastructure, education, improving workers' skills. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, take a guess. What are you thinking? You feeling lucky? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One way to keep track of what's going on in this economy is to measure things over time, right? Yes, statistics, of course, but also how people are reacting to what's going on. Last time there was a shutdown, in 2013, we found a woman who runs a steel company, some of whose business is in government contracts. We got her on the phone, and we got, believe you me, the straight scoop. So we have talked to Lisa Goldenberg plenty of times since. She is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania, and we have called her up once again. Lisa, good to talk to you.
Great to be with you.
We always say on Marketplace, you know, businesses hate uncertainty. And here we have maybe the apex of economic uncertainty. What's that doing to you?
Well, I think as the last time you and I spoke, I said we're kind of getting used to uncertainty. And the old adages of business hates uncertainty is getting redefined. What's uncertainty? Oh, we have a government shutdown. Yawn, yawn. Here we go again. We're tolerating uncertainty a lot more, which is healthy in many ways, right? Hmm. But it's kind of a new normal.
Hmm. What when you talk to your subcontractors or your suppliers, what are the conversations like?
Well, I think that what we've learned is that it's going to get fixed a lot quicker. I think when you and I first became friends so many years ago and we were dealing with a major shutdown that it really felt like a long black hole, that how are we going to come up with resolution? It's going to go on for forever, which scared contractors to death. And now we're in a different position. The economy's really rolling along at a much better level. I wouldn't say it's robust, but it's certainly growing. And the government in power has a majority, so they're going to figure it out regardless of the dearth of leadership that causes them to continuously walk away from the table.
Yeah, but wait a second. We're going to do this whole dance all over again now on February the 8th. That seems bananas.
Of course. I think it's a waste of time. I think it's a lack of leadership. It's a lack of focus. Something has to change. Someone has to rise to a leadership role that says, hey, guys, we got to sit at a table long enough for everyone to get along. Stop picking up your toys and leaving the sandbox.
Do you believe that's going to happen?
No. That's the problem. I think that at a certain point, a group of people are going to look at each other and say, we don't hate each other. We, in many ways, agree on more than we disagree. That's just not the party line.
Let me ask you the macroeconomic question here, just on something you talked about a minute ago. Things are feeling pretty good to you in this economy.
Absolutely. You know, from the beginning, what did I tell you? Steel loves Trump, and they're gaga for this environment. Even though old adages like business hates uncertainty, the market hates uncertainty, those adages are proving untrue. And I think we need to redefine uncertainty. because while it feels uncertain when we have shutdowns and two-week extensions and lack of leadership, the market's bumping along like no problem.
But I don't even know what to say, because redefining uncertainty seems – I don't even know.
Well, what do we think uncertainty is? The bar's been raised, Kai. Are we talking about, God forbid, you know, nuclear war?
Right.
Are we going to call that uncertainty? Are we going to talk about when the market is going to crash, because what goes up has to come down? The bar's been pushed way out.
So we've normalized stuff now, right? And we're like, eh.
Absolutely.
No. Right.
New normal. You have a government in power that has control of the House and the Senate and can't get along with each other. Well, that's a new normal. That used to be called uncertainty. We don't call that uncertainty anymore. We call that another day in Washington.
Lisa Goldenberg, the president of Delaware Steel of Pennsylvania. Lisa, thanks a lot. We'll talk soon.
Take care.
As we wait for all the congressional I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed on getting the government up and running again, a word here about the issue at the bottom of the whole disagreement. Not the DACA fix, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that is set to end in March, but the much bigger question that's kind of being danced around out there quite a bit, which is the vision for immigration overall in this country. President Trump and some Republicans in Congress are pushing to dramatically reduce legal immigration to the United States and to move the overarching concept from family reunification to a skills-based system, which means fewer workers in an already tight labor market. And as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, businesses are watching this whole thing with some anxiety.
Michael Bronner is president of Dr. Bronner's. You may know its iconic blue bottles of natural soap. He says the labor market is so tight, the company had to have a job fair.
We had about 17 jobs that we couldn't find the qualified workers for. So I think any restriction to the talent pool would have a detrimental effect on our business.
Bronner says up to half the company's employees are immigrants or children of immigrants. President Trump has supported cutting legal immigration by half and moving to a merit-based system that favors educated workers. Juliana Kerr is with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, a nonpartisan foreign policy think tank. She says the Midwest especially needs immigrants as baby boomers retire and thousands leave the region.
Construction industries, hospitality, agriculture. I mean, so many of these industries that are vital to our economy rely on all kinds of skills, but also low-skilled. And a merit-based system that only looks at education will not serve our needs.
People who want to limit legal immigration say it would support American workers and increase wages. But David Beer with the Libertarian Cato Institute says,
the best economic evidence on this shows that immigration increases wages overall for most Americans.
Most Americans, except the least educated. Research shows native-born people without high school diplomas can see their wages fall when there are more immigrants competing for the same jobs. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So here's a thought. The uncertainty of the government shutdown and what it says about how this country runs itself brought onto the global economic stage. The next round of negotiations over the North American Free Trade Agreement officially begins tomorrow in Montreal, the sixth of seven rounds this one is, so we are getting down to it. And now that there's a deal to get the government back open, the United States is going to have a full roster of negotiators at the talks. Negotiators who will be trying once again to hammer out a trade deal that President Trump has been threatening to abandon from the start. It's no secret that there hasn't been much artful deal-making in Washington of late, and the president has shown himself willing as ever to change his position and then change it again. Which means what for our international trade leverage at those talks in Montreal? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
It's a safe bet that Canada and Mexico haven't missed a move in Washington's shutdown showdown, and the White House and Congress are as divided over NAFTA as they are over everything else. Gary Huffbauer was a trade negotiator in the Carter administration. He says there's a lesson in all that turmoil for our NAFTA partners.
I mean, you might as well just stand your ground and hope that maybe the fluctuations in Washington move back in your direction.
That ground includes minimum requirements for North American content in vehicles, how long a renegotiated trade pact would last, and the NAFTA appeals process. Clayton Allen is an analyst at Height Analytics. He says President Trump's apparent lack of involvement in the weekend shutdown negotiations also didn't go unnoticed.
Maybe this is the sign that the Senate is willing to strike their own deals and to make the best of a situation without needing to look to the White House for leadership.
Allen says Canada and Mexico might try to do an end run around the White House, but one government shutdown does not a new world order make. The U.S. still buys a lot from its NAFTA partners.
We have a $177 billion trade deficit with Mexico and Canada last year.
Lori Wallach heads Public Citizens Global Trade Watch.
Mexico and Canada's exports are disproportionately aimed at the United States.
Even though the talks will run for about a week, negotiators still have to act fast. The final round of talks is scheduled for March. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I mean, the public comment period, I've never heard of it before today.
Public comments and why they matter in policymaking. But first, let's do the numbers. That shrug you hear, assuming you can hear shrugs, that was Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial's up 142 points, about 0.5%, 26,214 on the blue chips. NASDAQ climbed 71 points, 0.9%, 7408. S&P 500 gained 22, 0.8%, 28.32 there. This is interesting, I thought. Facebook should pay news publishers for their content if it really wants to fight misinformation. That came from Rupert Murdoch of News Corp. Came after Facebook said it's going to survey users to determine trustworthy news sources. You might remember that from the end of last week. Facebook shares up 2.25% today. News Corp, well, that was down 0.2%. Bond prices held steady. Yield on the 10-year T-note is at 2.65%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're rolling out a new project today across the Marketplace programs, marking 10 years since the economy basically broke, right? How the financial crisis and the 10 years we have just lived through have changed us in a project called Divided Decade. America is a different place than it was 10 years ago, not just economically, but politically and culturally, too. And when you're talking about change, the micro can sometimes tell you a great deal about the macro. So one of the things we're going to do over the next year is ask people all over this country to tell us how the financial crisis and the Great Recession changed them personally, their lives, their spending habits, how they feel about their futures. We're going to start today with a 33-year-old freelance designer from right here in Los Angeles named Michael Uphoff.
I came home from Iraq in 2005 and then enrolled in the GI Bill and went to college in 2007. And while in college, this all happened. I remember my father freaking out. His house went from being worth about $900,000 to worth like $400,000. That's everything he owned. And it got really strange when I'm going to art school and my whole family is asking me like what I'm going to do. Like, is that a financially viable career path? I think definitely because I had just come home from war and then I was busy in college and kind of, growing up a little bit, my father and I definitely started to have more adult conversations during that period of time. And I think it strengthened my relationship with my father. He became more of a mentor and he started to respect my opinions more and we became actually like really best friends. It's still not easy. And the day-to-day struggle is still what it is. And I have to work so hard to just find work. Trying to keep putting money aside for investments is challenging. Right now, I have a VA home loan, and I can't purchase a house in Los Angeles. Like, it's impossible. So I know eventually the housing's it's going to become an issue again. And we'll see where it goes, but it's inevitable. It's like here in Los Angeles, we keep waiting for the next big earthquake, like get ready for the next big financial crisis. It's just going to happen.
We've got some pictures of Michael Uphoff on our Instagram. It's at MarketplaceAPM. And while you're there, tell us, would you how the financial crisis changed you with the hashtag #HowWeChanged. It's all part of our year-long series, Divided Decade. You can also check out, by the way, a video preview on our website, marketplace.org. Thank you. We're going to go down the rabbit hole of federal regulations for a minute here. Not the policy of this regulation or that, but how any given regulation gets done. The Department of Labor has a new rule it wants to get on the books that would change the way restaurants treat tips. It's called the tip pooling rule. It'd let workers at the back of the house, dishwashers and prep cooks, for instance, share the tips made by servers in the front. It would also give employers, bosses, the right to decide how to distribute those tips. Not uncontroversial. So right now, we are in what's known as the public comment period on that rule, when the public gets to weigh in. Controversial rules like this one could get hundreds of thousands of comments. The FCC's recent proposal to do away with net neutrality, millions of comments. Now, whether they actually make a difference, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Tortilla Coast is a Tex-Mex restaurant not far from Capitol Hill. It's popular with congressional staffers and lobbyists who head there for happy hour. I stopped in recently during a shift change. Most of the workers I talked to didn't know about the tip pooling rule. So as far as commenting...
No, I didn't.
Honestly, not really, no.
No, ma'am.
I have not.
That last voice was Brian Johnson. He's a shift manager for Tortilla Coast.
I mean, the public comment period, I've never heard of it before today. And I like tend to think of myself as a fairly aware person politically.
Stephen Bella is a political science professor at George Washington University. He's been studying political participation and comment periods for 25 years. He says most people don't know about them.
For the garden variety regulation, I think there's essentially no public awareness that the regulation is being developed, let alone that there's the possibility for the public to get involved in that process.
Bala says most proposed regulations, and there are several thousand of them each year, are required to go through a notice and comment period, usually a month or two. Most of the time, a couple dozen responses come in, maybe a couple hundred. So what's up with those 200,000 plus comments on the tip pooling rule?
Oftentimes when you see large bodies of comments, it's because there's been group mobilization.
Usually by industry or advocacy groups, sometimes politicians and businesses. And they make it easy by letting people send a pre-written comment with a click or a text. So tens of thousands of comments on tip pooling, for instance, sound the same.
If adopted, this regulation would force a vulnerable workforce
further into poverty, economic instability,
and vulnerability to harassment and assault.
I urge the Department of Labor to withdraw this proposed rule.
Many commenters aren't in the restaurant industry at all. Take 79-year-old Shirley Elizabeth Barnes.
My last position was U.S. ambassador to Madagascar.
So what prompted her to weigh in on tip pooling? Her dad.
He was a waiter on the Seaboard Airlines Railroad. And for a long time, we existed as a family of five people on his work as a waiter and also very much on the tips that he made.
She submitted one of those boilerplate comments online, but says it reflects her feelings. Stephen Bala, the comment expert from GW, says just registering your opposition or support for a proposed rule may not make much of a difference.
It's not a vote-taking exercise. So the sheer number of comments in and of itself doesn't have any necessary connection to the agency's ultimate decisions.
He says agencies are looking for stories and arguments and evidence for why a rule should change. The USDA, for instance, revamped standards for labeling products organic after a flood of comments. But millions of comments opposing the recent FCC rule to end net neutrality didn't change a thing. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today about which, first of all, go Eagles because, come on, right? But second of all, don't write to me. United Airlines knows a business opportunity when it sees one. The carrier has added a whole bunch of flights out of Minneapolis that Sunday of the Super Bowl. The game is going to be played in the Twin Cities. My personal favorite under the what could possibly go wrong category, a 3:30 Monday morning red eye to Boston after the game. Look out. Giants fan, for the record. And yes, yes, I know. All right, we're out of here. The Dow Industrial is up 142 today, about a half percent. NASDAQ up 71, 0.9%. S&P 500 up 22, 0.8%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.